Hello, friends. Welcome to another edition of the Indian Conflict Resolution Podcast, hosted by the Online Indian Journal of Peace and Conflict Resolution. I'm your host, Dr. Jyoti M. Pathania, in conversation with one of the most influential and well-known journalists of the Jammu and Kashmir region, Mr. Arun Joshi, the editor-in-chief of JNK News Today. Prior to this, he was the senior resident editor from Srinagar and Jammu region. He has worked with the Times of India, Indian Express, Kashmir Times. He was a deputy editor of Hindustan Times, and he covered Kashmir during the peak of militancy from August 1990 to 2012. His specialization is conflict reporting, and his publications include four books: Eyewitness Kashmir, Reconciliation of Civilization, Styles of George Will Orwell and Demilitarization, Myth or Reality. To begin with, you know, in our conversations, as you know, we talk about the peace building processes. So I just wanted to know, in Jammu and Kashmir, like you had also mentioned, that, you know, normalcy is interpreted as peace. While in fact, what we are witnessing, especially after the abrogation of 370, is a transition where things can take any direction unless some systematic changes are effected in the real-time interest of peace. These are your wordings. So I want you to allude on this so that our listeners understand what exactly are you meaning when you're saying systematic changes in the real-time interest of peace. Over to you, Mr. Joshi.
Thank you very much for such a grand introduction of mine. So the question is, as you asked, and normalcy, the kind of normalcy which Jammu and Kashmir is witnessing for the past over 4 years, especially after the abrogation of Article 370, is unprecedented in a sense that never before, since 1989, Jammu and Kashmir had experienced this kind of normalcy where the people were confident about their lives, their workplaces, and their return to homes. Having said that, the question is, this normalcy cannot be interpreted as permanent peace. It is not the peace which Jammu and Kashmir had been looking for, because This has not brought the emotional connect with the people. Let me say, first of all, revocation of Article 370 was an administrative decision which was given a political coloring, and it evoked a political response from both the sides, those who favored it and those who opposed it. That dilemma is still continuing. And as a result of that, the conflict in the mind has not evaporated. I mean, unless that goes away, there can be no permanent peace. So the change has to be brought, that the change that needs to be brought in is to emotionally connect with the people, with all the development, with all the normalcy, with all the anti-terrorism operations, and all the unprecedented windfall of tourists in Kashmir. That is not happening. It's only an economic outlook, it's only a physical achievement, but as far as heart to heart is concerned, there are many things which are missing. So, first of all, the government of India will have to live up to its promises, what it promised. What people in Jammu and Kashmir want is that they should be treated as Indians like other Indians in the rest of the country. So that is not happening, because there are certain laws which are, I mean, there was a proposal to impose property tax, there was a proposal to set up prepaid smart meters. Of course, this is happening in the rest of the country. But in Jammu and Kashmir, which doesn't have a habit of doing so, there was a need for the gradual things to happen, and you cannot treat whether administratively or politically. Jammu and Kashmir just overnight change. You cannot bring overnight change.
Yeah.
I mean, habits of 72 years cannot go away just in few hours or few days. So that is what I'm saying is emotional connect that is to be brought instead of telling Jammu and Kashmir, you do this, you don't do this. Do's and don'ts cannot be defined, and that cannot bring the peace. You have to emotionally connect, especially the government of India and also the countrymen. They should treat Kashmir not as a destination, tourist destination, but as an emotional destination. And they want to be treated not specially, but as Indians, like in the rest of the country.
Great. That's a very you know, I should say, an insight of a person who's a localite who belongs to that place, and you know, who better can say those words than you, who has lived there and born and brought up there for so many years, and writing on it as well. So you know, since you spoke about abrogation of Article 370 also, you know, the narrative of peace existing in the JNK Valley, can you do a brief comparative assessment for us, as in what was the narrative of peace before, and what is the narrative of peace after the abrogation of Article 370? If we do a comparison, could you just give us about 2 to 3 points in each so that the comparison can be drawn?
There are two things which we need to think about, and which we must think over. First of all, what was the status of Jammu and Kashmir pre-August 5, 2019, when Article 370 was revoked? That time the peace was, idea was that you win over the militants, you win over separatists, and make them a stakeholder in peace-building process. But unfortunately, within the separatist ranks and within the militant ranks, there was a dilemma. They were not very sure as to how to proceed. They didn't have a roadmap. The government of India did invite them, and there were three meetings with the All Parties Hurriyat Conference also in 2004 and 2005 and 2006. But these did not materialize anywhere. So the idea of peace was on winning over the separatists, not the public. So by making separatists as stakeholders, government of India was making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what reflected in the violence. And before the abrogation of Article 370, what we should remember, there were guns, there were bombs, and there were times when there were massacres. And this generated amnesty, especially when we talk of 1990s. We must look at what kind of life was there. There was a shutdown for days together, and even if on a normal day, Srinagar city, the capital city of Jammu and Kashmir, would turn into a ghost town in the afternoon, with no curfew calls, with no curfew imposition, because there was so much of fear. And this fear was gradually increasing. Before, militancy got criminalized, and when militancy got criminalized, it complicated the matters. Then there were surrendered militants who rebelled against the supremacy of Pakistani militant groups like Hizbul Mujahideen, Al-Jihad, and all that. Thereafter, JKLF also turned towards them, and what exactly turned out was that there was a fear. There was no life at all. There was a life of conflict in mind, conflict in sports fields, conflict in schools, and conflict in society. So there was, you couldn't think of normal life without bringing in picture the conflict itself, which was manifested in guns, bombs, massacres. Thereafter, it took another turn, that was stones. In 2008, two stones were brought in, and those were given out as what is called softer version of the militancy, as a peaceful version of militancy and peaceful rebellion to get the issues resolved. This was one picture. Second is that you were looking at pre-1989 peace, when Kashmir was calm and tourists would come, people would enjoy late into the night. That became a dream. And now that peace was inbuilt. That was inherent. Kashmiris, though they were having their separatist thoughts also at that time, but there was not much of anti-India sentiment. Anti-India sentiment grew after the 1987 elections, which were rigged. So that is one kind of peace pre-1989. Then we were looking at the peace through separatists. That is it. Now, after the abrogation of Article 370, it was the use of force which brought peace. There were hundreds of troops, additional troops, which were brought in Kashmir Valley before the abrogation of Article 370. And then internet was cut down, where even landline phones went dead. For almost 1 year, there was no smooth internet connect. So that is how they snapped the relationship between, they snapped the communication. And what happened next was that COVID came, and COVID was help for them. It gave excuse to both the sides to justify what is happening. Now, after the COVID was over, Government of India pushed on two things: an intensified anti-terrorism operations, stuck at the ecosystem of terrorism. That is, who facilitated them, who funded them, who empathized with them, militancy. So they stuck at all of them, and at the same time projected Kashmir as a destination for tourists to come. And tourists responded like anything. Tourists from India, not foreign countries, but post G20 meeting in May this year, that is 2023, the foreign tourists have also come. But at the same time, what you have witnessed is that this peace, the people don't believe in this peace is a permanent peace. They don't think that, because there are physical appearances of threats and there are invisible threats. Now, recently what happened on the day India lost to Australia in the World Cup, there was students in the Sher-e Kashmir Agricultural University who celebrated the defeat, raised pro-Pakistan slogans, and the interpretation of which was given by the police that it was not merely the pro-Pakistan slogans or something celebrating Australia's win over India, but it was to convey a message that everyone in Jammu and Kashmir hates India. That is a police version, police statement. So that you can understand that how the things are being interpreted in a manner in which you can read between the lines at any time. And these between the lines, in which the physical threats also are apparent, and there are invisible. This speaks of the mindset of the students. And students, that means the age group between 15 and 25, is a huge problem at the moment. That is how I will sum up these things.
Like you mentioned, the peace building process in JNK, you know, it has to go beyond zero tolerism. towards zero tolerism to terrorism.
Towards terrorism.
Yes, and we must, like you said, build sustainable peace. Now, I want to understand from you, when you say sustainable peace, how and what are the ways and means to create this sustainable peace? One I understood was an emotional quotient. You said you have to connect with the mind, minds and the mindset of the people in Jammu and Kashmir. That's one way. What are the other ways in which we can build sustainable peace?
First of all, in all the development and all the activities, positive activities which are taking place, those have to be, those need to be seen, and government should make efforts that whole thing for 72 years was not wrong. After all, there was governance, there were elections, there were people were participating in the process of peace building. Even in worst of the times, when talking of peace and politics meant instant death, that time also the people were taking risk. Now the question is, what you need to do is, you got to create an ecosystem of peace.
Systematic changes. You mean some systems?
Yeah, systematic changes in a sense.
But what are those?
First of all, there is no public participation in the matters of governance.
Okay.
There is one left-hand governor. He is doing good job. But he is single individual. He has one advisor who is from outside.
Right.
Outside means outside of JNK. Mm-hmm. And there were three advisors who were locals. But all of them have been eased out. And there is a bureaucracy, most of which doesn't understand the basic ethos of Kashmir. They don't understand the language, they don't understand the geography. And
But I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you have the JNK cadre bureaucracy as well. Who can be part of the development and the peace building processes in Jammu and Kashmir, and help to build in those systems by which people have faith in the government and the development process. And then the process carries on.
True, but JNK cadre has been incorporated with Egmont. Now it is no longer JNK cadre.
Yeah,
after
correct.
The reorganization of the state.
Correct.
And what has happened is that most of the officers, now, there is a category of JNK cadre. I'll explain it a bit. They are natives.
Right.
Some officers of JNK cadre were natives. And others were JNK cadre from outside.
Right.
Now, natives, I can understand, and you can also understand, they have a better communication with the people they deal with. And the JNK cadre people who came in the 80s, 70s, or even in 90s, they knew that for next three decades or so, they will be in Jammu and Kashmir. So they built their social and network, and they also made friends, and natives also made friends with them. So they became semi-natives, and who understood. Because they knew that they have to spend 30 years, 35 years in JNK only. So that connect has been strapped. In a sense that most of those JNK cadre officers of, JNK origin and non-natives also, they have been eased out of the bureaucracy. Now, this is a complex situation which cannot be dealt with. By the outside bureaucracy. Now the outside bureaucracy, which is coming, they come here for a tenure of maximum 2 years. So why should they be investing in Jammu and Kashmir or their thoughts? Or their only purpose would be to make 10 to 5, okay, duty over, that's all. They don't have to look for their friends or social circle inside JNK. So that's also making a difference. Having made that point, now what I'm saying is that youth is not having hope. Youth is looking for jobs. And now what has happened over the past 3 years? There have been several exams conducted by SSP, that is Service Selection Board, that of police sub-inspectors, that of junior engineers, that of teachers and all that. Unfortunately, what has happened that each of these exams and results thereof have been challenged in the court and they have been found to be corruption ridden. So the basic idea of saying that for 72 years you were being ruled by corrupt rulers and we'll be giving you a corruption-free atmosphere, there's a contradiction in it. And the people are understanding. And let me say it at the risk of saying it, that people in Jammu and Kashmir, especially Kashmir Valley, they are very, very intelligent. They are emotional, but they are very, very intelligent also, and much more than some of the IAS and IPS officers which are here. So they understand the whole dimension. And at the same time, they understand their fate lies with India. But India should give them chance to build bridges with them. That is not happening. Jobs are not there. I mean, there is mining. I mean, I'm just explaining it. Mining rights have been snatched. I mean, the open auction and the people from outside have come. If I tell you that our bricks come from Punjab for the construction, what will happen to the local bricklayer? So this is how the local has been marginalized and outsiders have been on premium here.
Right. All right. You know, as a journalist, you know, by profession and, you know, having worked for so many years into this profession, into the media, I just want to know your perspective as a journalist. What role has media played in establishing peace in the region so far? And how? Take your personal experiences and, you know, maybe explain it to the listeners that what role has the media played?
Well, to be very honest about it, media since the days of eruption of militancy has played a very, very negative role. Very, very negative role. It continues till today. I mean, the colors have changed, but the fact is media has played a very negative role. Objectivity was made hostage by militants.
Right.
They would often issue threats and they even killed, journalists. So, I can say, I was just talking in 1992, two Swedish engineers were picked up by militants, captive, and I, around 9:30, I was speaking to one of my colleagues, Shaban Vakil, he was the editor of Al Safa. He's saying that they have been traced, their Uri border and all that. So, okay, I thought that he knew it better. So everybody was looking for that story. So 20 minutes later, I heard that the Shaman Vakil has been shot dead. So what happens to you? It immediately brings fear to your mind.
Right.
And the local journalists, let's be, of course, they worked under immense pressure. They were having families, they were, there was physical threat as well as invisible threat that if you cross the line, you are gone. Either you will be threatened, your paper will be banned, you will be banned, you will be kidnapped, you will be kept in captivity. And this was happening from both the sides. Post 1995, when this rebels started rebellion started in militant groups, twice they kidnapped 25 journalists once and 30 journalists for the other time. I mean, this was the kind of atmosphere in which the journalists were operating. So they started self-censoring themselves, and anybody writing the truth about them, I mean, was not on the hit list, but at least there was a assumption that he may be shot dead any time. So then there was another fear, because that was, you had to listen to different militant groups. Each one of them, that was not electronic era, electronic media era, each one was dictating terms. My press note should come front page on the, as a banner, some on the front page. If somebody was relegated to the inside pages, then the editor had it. Bullets were sent to them as a warning. Look, you behave or you are gone. So this was that kind.
But now this pressure must not be there, Mr. Joshi.
Yes, of course, now I'm coming to that only. Right. What has happened is that now the media is not divided. It is going one side. This has to carry on one side of the story only.
Okay.
I mean, even if I know that somebody has been shot dead by militants,
right,
I cannot write it unless police says so.
Oh, I see.
And then if I challenge what is happening in the system, that also has consequences. Advertisements of the newspapers have been stopped, which have been challenging the system of the day. So everything is not hunky-dory, but we, I mean, media has been, it is also self-censoring. They have stopped writing any critical pieces. Of course, the good thing is that they are now talking about education, health, environment, and other things, which they were not doing during the peak of militancy. Or during militancy, or they did not, I mean, how they destroyed peace was not only that they glamorized guns and bombs at one point, and stones at the other. So the stones were sanctified. That is also fact. Now that is not there, but it's a other kind of censorship, self-censorship, which is happening. So that is why the real peace methodology doesn't come out. I mean, nobody dared to write what Al-Party Suriyat conference is saying. Even if they are saying that you hold a dialogue with Pakistan, that even the mainstream leaders at the national level say. So, but if it is projected from Hurriyat conference or from any separatist quarter, then you are dubbed as anti-national.
So, taking on from this, what are the real dangers to the peace process in the region?
The real danger is from within. Pakistan, of course, is known. Pakistan has invested so much, and they would like to continue with the troubles. And now drones are coming, weapons are coming, drugs are coming from Pakistan. That is one, that is a known factor. But the real factor is when the people are not identifying themselves with the system, they are not identifying, then they don't take ownership of the development. When, and let us be very, very clear that the political ideology of militancy or our youth has been shaped by schools, government schools even, government schools. And of course, we are talking about Jamaat-e-Islami run madrasas, but madrasas played one disastrous role in shaping the political ideology. Who were the teachers in the government schools?
Right.
They were also the product of Islamic ideology.
Right.
They were, and till date, except for few schools, You don't have a national anthem. National anthem is not being sung all across the valley. No. The substitute is Sare Jahan Se Acha Hindustan Hamara. But national anthem is not there. This is what it is. And holding flags, tricolors in your hand is one good optic. Your Dal Lake is very clean now, very good optics. You don't see any stone throwing, very good optics. But if the police jeeps are wailing all around with the sirens, army jeeps are going with three escorts, so that's a contradiction in itself. That
Yeah,
contradiction.
correct. You're right. You're absolutely right. But then you yourself said 72 years of the habit cannot be just undone in few years. So I think you need to give time even to the security forces for them also to slowly and gradually wean away from the region. And I think that is something which needs to be worked out. It has to be sustained. Sustained effort where slowly and gradually the forces, as and when the conditions are improving, they also try and wean out from the valley. Because like you said, the youths, we need to put that and we don't have to put it has to come in within the youth of Jammu and Kashmir that this is my land and I need to do something for the development of my land. And when you yourself develop, when the youth himself or herself get educated, they feel they are a contributor to the development of their land. So, what are your,
Absolutely.
yeah. So I think,
Absolutely, what you're saying is correct.
yeah.
But the question is the security forces also, they have worked tremendously under tremendous pressures.
Right.
And if I recall, one of my friends, he recalled that he had the blood stains of 300 of his colleagues on his uniform who were killed by militants or in crossfire or anti-militancy operations. So one can understand how much sacrifice they have made. I mean, rather it's beyond our imagination, even if they have not been killed, even if they are not been injured. But standing alone and you never knew, you never know that from which side the grenade will come to you, which side the man hiding you, AK-47 will shoot at you. So
Absolutely.
that is the, I can narrate you the incidents. Then we can go on and go on, go on.
No,
But
but I think to just summarize all that we had a conversation about, don't you think, and I feel you will agree with me that there are various stakeholders in establishing sustainable peace in Jammu and Kashmir region. Whether it is the police, local administration, the defense, the media, but most of all, I think it's the civil society. It's and includes in the civil society, it's the youth, like you mentioned, which needs to be the bearer, the torch bearer of peace building processes in Jammu and Kashmir region. I think that is the core of the argument that we've had in our conversation. Mr. Badoshi, I'd like to thank you once again.
thank you very much. Thank you very much.